From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, this is Politically Georgia. I'm Bill Nigut. The 2024 session of the General Assembly is over. Today, we'll look at the outcomes of some of the most closely watched measures of a contentious session.
I'm Greg Bluestein. Before the final gavel fell, lawmakers passed measures aimed at cracking down on illegal immigration, as well as a bill establishing new oversight of elections. But a number of restrictions focused on transgender youth and a bill limiting mining near the Okefenokee Swamp failed to reach a final vote.
I'm Tia Mitchell. Bills that ease the tax burden on homeowners are on their way to the governor's desk for his signature, but a controversial religious freedom bill and a push to reduce the state's generous film tax credits died as the session came to an end.
A special sine die edition of Politically Georgia. We invite you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss an episode of Politically Georgia.
In Atlanta, one voice has stood out for over four decades. An AJC original, The Monica Pearson Show.
Let's talk about how you got to ESPN.
Revealing interviews.
You are known as America's doctor, but I want to know who you were before that.
When you have a different name, you have different color skin, it can be tough.
With Atlanta's most famous faces as you've never seen them before.
I'm telling my story. This is the American dream.
The Monica Pearson Show, streaming now on AJC.com.
Hip-hop is a product of black people. It's a product of black song and celebration.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution presents
hip-hop's most pulled elements are pulled from the South.
A Southern hip-hop story.
We always go back to that moment of the Source Awards.
Everybody wants your rhythm, but they don't want your blues.
The biggest names in hip-hop.
Atlanta is still the mecca for hip-hop.
50 years.
No one can deny.
One film.
The power of the South now.
The South got something to say. Streaming now at AJC.com/hip-hop.
We've got a lot to talk about on today's show with Greg Bluestein, who is here in the studio, Tia Mitchell, who joins us from Washington, and WABE politics reporter Sam Greenglass. Sam and Greg, you were out very late or very early this morning covering the final set day of the legislative session. Sam, we've decided that based on what you told us, we do not want to be on the road if you get into a car today.
Yeah, I'm going to be staying home. I think we finished just before 1 a.m. and then a couple hours of sleep, restless night later. Here we are talking politics.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. Greg Bluestein, the session finally ended around 1 o'clock.
12:59 a.m. I think it's a record, Sam. I think we experienced history. They have gone past midnight multiple times, but I don't think they've ever gone as late as they did last night.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
All right. We survived.
So let's get started on that. There are lots of highlights that we can talk about, but Greg, if you don't mind, I want to start with something that I think surprised many people, and that is that some of the real red meat conservative issues that the Senate had served up failed to get a final vote in the House and are dead until they're reintroduced next year.
Yeah, sometimes the biggest stories of these nights are what didn't pass, not what did pass. And a lot of, you know, dozens of measures did pass, but what didn't pass were a lot of those election year measures that were really pushed by the Senate. The Senate became this launching pad for divisive social conservative legislation. And there was never a question that a lot of that wouldn't pass, but it was more of what will the House let pass? In the end, the House blocked pretty much every really controversial measure. We're talking MAGA license plates, a Clarence Thomas statue at the state judicial building, a religious liberty revival, measures that would control how public school teachers can talk about gender and sex in classrooms, transgender initiatives that the LGBT community was really against, and the list goes on and on and on.
Yes, Sam, were you at all surprised that, you know, it'd be one thing if the House decided not to take up, say, one or two of them, but they basically rejected all of those culture war issues. Did that surprise you at all?
You know, one of our reporters, this was his first session, our education reporter, and throughout the night I was kind of counseling him, okay, these bills are coming up in the Senate, but that doesn't mean that they have a clear shot at passing. Wait and see what the House does. And, you know, this is my third session, and I've seen this go both ways, right? Like, two sessions ago, we had a bill related to trans kids in school sports. That one did end up coming up for a vote in the House and passing. Last year, this measure to restrict most forms of gender-affirming care for trans kids, that ended up coming up for a vote and passing. So it can kind of go either way. And last night, you know, sure enough, Speaker Burns put a kibosh on some of these things, did not bring them up for a vote, these two measures. And I think we saw a tweet from the president of Georgia Equality saying we defeated both of the anti-LGBTQ measures that we were fighting throughout
the session. Yeah, Jeff Graham did, and he kept people very informed about how those measures were or were not moving forward as the session continued and finally ended last night. Tia, one thing that did pass really takes us into your territory as well, and that's the immigration bills that really were the result largely of the really awful death of Laken Riley by a man accused of killing her who was in the country without authorization. And you know, when Republicans introduced those measures, they certainly talked about the failures of Joe Biden and the administration to deal with immigration and blamed him in part for her death. So they decided to act here in Georgia to toughen laws dealing with immigrants.
Yeah, and I would be, I want to hear from Sam and Greg, because my understanding was there were multiple kind of proposals put out there. Can you help me understand, as someone who was trying to keep up with all that you guys were covering, what actually did and did not pass as far as limiting immigration? And as a follow-up to that, do you think there will be some tension with the federal government like we're seeing with Texas?
I think that one of the bigger questions is, will there be tension with local sheriffs and law enforcement officials who are worried that this is a new burden on them? I mean, and a lot of those guys are already overstretched. They're already facing, you know, limited budgets and hard times to hire new employees and deputies and all that. But what did pass was essentially a legislation that would require law enforcement officers to verify the immigration status of people they arrest and cooperate with federal authorities. To let federal authorities know when they arrest someone who might not be in the country legally. And a lot of local sheriffs already were doing that. This would just mandate that the few who don't do that voluntarily now have to do that. And of course, it was all, these measures were pending before Laken Riley's death, her tragic killing. But of course, that became the new impetus to pass these measures because they weren't going anywhere before that. Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting to watch lawmakers respond in real time to current events, both on this immigration issue, but also the Alabama IVF ruling. That legislation did not end up passing. But to see lawmakers jump on the news of the day and try and respond to it in legislation, I think was something really important to watch this session. And I think the other thing on this immigration point, Tia, is how Democrats and Republicans framed this issue so differently. You know, Republicans were saying we are trying to respond with a policy measure that may have been able to prevent this tragedy from happening, while Democrats were accusing Republicans of politicizing a tragedy. And I think these kind of conversations around immigration are just going to keep playing out here in Georgia as we get closer to the 2024 election, when we know Republicans have really leaned on immigration in terms of criticizing Joe Biden as a campaign issue. So I don't think rhetoric around this topic is going away anytime soon over the next couple of months.
And remember, Governor Kemp has 40 days to sign or veto bills, and that will mean a 40-day process where he'll tease out some of these important bill signings, you know, that are consequential for not just Georgia, but also politically, of course. So expect a bill signing ceremony for something like this immigration measure that he'll use to pummel Joe Biden. But Sam, something else you mentioned was that IVF bill. I want to mention that because we wrote in the morning newsletter yesterday, expect the unexpected. And that was one of the most unexpected things happening out of the Georgia House. Late yesterday, there was a bipartisan resolution that the speaker put his name on, Speaker John Burns, that it has no binding effect, but it's a sort of a symbol, a statement of priorities. It said the Georgia House prioritizes IVF treatment. Again, no legal consequence of it, but it was a privileged resolution, which meant that it goes in the books and it was adopted without any sort of debate, any sort of divisiveness in the Georgia House.
And I think that underlies something that's different about this session compared to, say, last year, which is that we are in an election year, and that dynamic kind of undergirds everything that we're talking about. On the one hand, you have these red meat culture war issues to, you know, rally a Republican base before a primary, which is in 2 months from now. But also you have these measures like the IVF resolution that got bipartisan backing as a lot of, you know, Republicans in the House prepare for some kind of tight races in the general election in November in some of these suburban districts. So I think this election dynamic, you know, is one thing that makes this session different from, say, an off year.
Exactly right. In the Senate, most Georgia senators face very little competition. They're in safe districts for the most part. In the House, there's about a half dozen to a dozen really swing districts. And Speaker Burns was thinking about that as he pushed forward some of these measures and also blocked some others.
Let's take up another issue that we spent a lot of time talking about, Tia, and that's the election bills that were presented at the General Assembly. I think we were on together with Mark Nisi, our reporter who covers elections, the other day, and I painted a somewhat dire picture of further attempts to relitigate the 2020 election and to, you know, point out that Republicans think it was fraudulent. Nisi walked me back from the cliff. He said they're not really all that that dramatic. But at the same time, Tia, they were, again, sort of a Republican reminder to the public that they maybe should think that that 2020 election was fraudulent.
Right. It's kind of allows Republicans to appease those in their party who believe that there were problems with the 2020 election while still... They, number one, don't go that far, don't do that much. And then when they get criticism from maybe Democrats or from the left saying, why are you tinkering with our election laws? They can say, well, these are small tweaks to make it more secure, you know. So it really allows Republicans to play to all sides on their messaging in ways that I know really frustrates Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, we heard last night from Democratic Representative Syra Draper, who said, I can't believe we are justifying sloppy and rush policy choices by saying we need to bring more confidence to our elections when the people who don't believe in the confidence of the elections will never be confident. I think she compared it to negotiating with terrorists, negotiating with election deniers. And I think this is a dynamic that we've seen, you know, over the last couple of years, but especially again in an election year. And we also saw that Republicans placed a priority on this. This SB 89, which was an omnibus package of a bunch of these election measures, removing Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger from the state election board, bulking up some rules around mass voter challenges, eventually stopping the use of QR codes from tabulating ballots by 2026, hand-marked paper ballots in some local races in 2025. All of these measures were kind of pulled together under SB 189 at the very last minute, approved by the Senate for final passage after midnight last night. And I think that just underscores the priority Republicans are placing on showing their voters that they are working on elections every single year.
And Bill, there's another important provision that was slipped into this bill with very little debate. We talked about expect the unexpected. This was definitely unexpected. There's a provision that makes it easier for independent candidates for president to get on the ballot in Georgia. Basically says as long as they're also on the ballot in at least 20 other states or territories, they automatically get on Georgia's ballot. That could mean it must be much easier for RFK Jr., Cornel West, No Labels candidate, whoever that might be, to get on the Georgia ballot.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because it's interesting that that just got slipped in and there was no debate. I'm assuming...
No debate before this.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's what I mean. Republicans, I assume, like that idea because they tend to believe that any independent candidate on the Georgia ballot will probably take away from President Biden, yes?
That's the thought. I personally disagree with that.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy seems to be getting pull from the Trump side.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, my anecdotal evidence suggests that as well. When I went to RFK's rally and the two dozen people or so I interviewed were almost all Trump supporters or people who would, you know, be more likely to support a Republican candidate. But, you know, that goes, you know, Cornel West, whoever the No Labels person, look, there's still a relatively low bar, currently third-party candidates must collect 7,500 signatures to get on the ballot. It's not a huge lift for a national campaign to get on Georgia's ballot, but this makes it even easier if they are already on the ballots in 20 other states. So that's a significant change.
You know, Tia, that the possibility that that could have an impact on Donald Trump as much as Joe Biden is one of those moments when you talk about beware of what you wish for in terms of a particular piece of legislation, because it just may not have the consequences you expect it to.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, that's one of the crazy things about Signe Dye is that things are moving so quickly that, you know, it's often been remarked that these lawmakers sometimes don't even get a chance to grasp what they're doing, let alone...
They haven't even read it.
Yeah, they haven't even read it. It's all coming super fast, and let alone to think about further steps down the line. Can I ask a quick kind of broader question? And that's, why is the state Senate, Burt Jones aside, the state Senate is known as being more conservative in the House, and usually the conventional wisdom is opposite because state senators have bigger territories, mm-hmm. districts, and therefore you would think that they would have to be a little bit more moderate than in the House. That's what most states see. That's what we see in the U.S. Senate. Why is the Georgia Senate different in that way?
It's been that way for a while.
Yeah,
right.
It's such a good question. I think part of the answer is that they're not in very competitive districts. There might not be a really truly competitive state Senate district in November at all, where there's about a dozen House districts that are. And of course, there's fewer state senators. That might be one reason. The other reason, Tia, I think, is because lieutenant governors tend to want to run for governor. And to do that, you've got to go curry the base for favor. And, you know, we saw that with Casey Cagle. There was thought that Jeff Duncan would want to seek higher office. We certainly saw that with Zell Miller way back in the day and others, Democratic lieutenant governors. And certainly Burt Jones is looking at that in 2026.
By the way, Zell Miller, who I think I'm right, 16 years as lieutenant governor before he finally got a chance to move up.
And I think it's worth noting here to that point, which I think is a very astute, Greg. Most states, the lieutenant governor does not have as much power mm-hmm. as Georgia's lieutenant governor has. Most states, the lieutenant governor is pretty ceremonial, more like the vice president, as you know, whereas in Georgia, the lieutenant governor really does have a lot of power as the actual person who controls the Senate.
That's a really good point. Sam, let's go back to this so-called Franken bill. We already talked about the fact that this put together a lot of the culture war issues the Senate was interested in. But let's break it down a little bit more. It didn't go very far at all.
Yeah, so we're talking about HB 1104. And, you know, I want to point out that this originally was a bill that had to do with mental health for student athletes. It was something that probably would have attracted bipartisan support. It was proposed by, I think, a freshman lawmaker, Democrat Representative Amari Crawford, who basically watched the nitty-gritty of sausage-making and politics of what happens to bills sometimes, especially when you're in the minority party. His very simple, probably popular bill suddenly became this vehicle for all of these other things that were not going to attract bipartisan support. And, you know, one point that we heard Democrats making is this was a bill designed to prevent suicide among young people. But in the end, it ended up with some measures that focused on transgender youth who, as we know, have higher rates of suicide and mental health challenges. And this had, you know, five or six measures, everything from limiting sex education to the locker rooms that student athletes use to, you know, further reaffirming this 2022 law that paved the way to prevent trans kids from playing school sports. And, you know, in the end, this did not pass, but I think it highlighted some of the divisions in the legislature, especially the quickness with which it was thrown together. You know, we heard Democrats remarking that they didn't even have opponents lined up to come and testify against this bill because it was put forward in committee with almost no notice to even the Democratic lawmakers on the panel. And I think that is a dynamic that we see crop up again and again when the majority really wields their power to shove through measures that they want, but the other side will not.
Yeah, in the words of Democratic State Senator Elena Perron, it became a last-minute amalgamation of a number of wrongheaded culture war bills. And frankly, a lot of Republicans agreed with that. You know, this was exactly as Sam said, this was a bipartisan widely, you know, lauded suicide prevention bill that last minute was turned into something else. And it was really interesting, Bill, because when the Senate passed this vote, it didn't end up reaching a vote in the House. It ended up getting blocked. But when the Senate passed this, Amari Crawford stood there. He's a House member, stood there in the Senate chamber, kind of staring at each Republican speaker, you know, to make sure that they knew that how opposed he was, that his well-intentioned suicide prevention bill that had broad bipartisan support was turned into this, what we call a Franken bill.
Yeah, an unfortunate introduction to the ways of the General Assembly for
welcome to the GA, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to a break, which we got to do fairly soon, Greg, let me ask you and then Sam, please respond too. So we have two new leaders, as we've talked about, Burt Jones in the Senate. We have a new speaker in the House, Speaker Burns. Just very quickly, Greg, what did we learn about each of them and what their interests and their styles are in their first full sessions, really, as leaders?
I think we really learned about how savvy Speaker Burns is. It takes two to tango, and in the end, he blocked a number of red meat measures that he thought would make some vulnerable House incumbents even more vulnerable in the end, and really controlled the dynamic that last day. And one of the things he did that Burt Jones, the lieutenant governor, didn't do was address the media afterwards. A press conference with six or seven of his deputies allowed him to kind of direct the narrative even more after that grueling final day of the legislative session. And I think we learned a lot that way.
And Sam, we should say, Speaker Burns, much in the style and tradition of his predecessor, David Ralston, refusing to bow to those really right-wing culture war issues that the Senate loves to send across. Your very quick thoughts on Burns and Jones.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the top of Burns' press conference, he mentioned that the House is about results and not politics. You know, a subtle dig there at the other side of the chamber. But, you know, one other thing I want to note on this, too, there will also be a changeover in leadership on the Democratic side next year. Senate Minority Leader Gloria Butler, House Minority Leader James Beverly, they're both retiring, and that could open the doors for a younger generation of Democratic leadership as these margins get slimmer. So that'll be interesting to watch, too.
All right, Sam Greenglass, thank you so much for your observations about the legislature. We're going to let you go and try to get a little rest after your long night, but thanks for being with us. This is Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Donald Trump has been indicted in Atlanta.
We have so many court dockets to follow, but we haven't really seen anything yet.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution has covered every moment of this historic case.
I've been writing about this investigation for 2.5 years.
Our team is led by reporters Bill Rankin and Tamar Hallerman. Follow our coverage on AJC.com and listen to new in-depth episodes of the award-winning podcast, Breakdown, The Trump Indictment, only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Twice daily, delivered straight to your email, you can receive the AJC's Politically Georgia newsletter. Stay on top of all the important news, scoops, and exclusives from the AJC politics team. Just go to ajc.com/newsletters to sign up today. That's ajc.com/newsletters. All right, guys, best behavior time?
I'm nervous.
Because the boss is on. Andrew Morris is joining us. Andrew, president and publisher of the AJC. And this appearance, Andrew, I want to say we're really pleased you're here. But I do want to make sure that we say to our listeners, this isn't just some gratuitous effort to have you on and to sing your praises. You've been deeply involved in a very serious matter down at the General Assembly. And that is the effort among many lawmakers, among conservationists, environmentalists, to try to prevent mining near one of the great natural resources, not just in Georgia, but in the world, the Okefenokee Swamp. And so we want to talk with you about why you decided to pick this up and take it on. But before we do that, I think we need to hear from Greg Bluestein about what happened to the bill that we thought maybe was going to get heard yesterday, the bill that would have protected, to some extent, the swamp from mining. Greg, on our show yesterday, Majority Leader Steve Gooch was here. Patricia and I, we grilled him on that question. Was he going to bring this up? The House passed it overwhelmingly. And Gooch made it clear to us in somewhat subtle ways it wasn't going to happen. And you were able to push that out pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I don't think it was even that subtle. He said, hey, guys, I think this should be up to regulatory agencies, the Environmental Protection Division, and not to the legislature, and said that many members of his caucus felt the same way. That being said, there was a lot of intrigue and drama throughout the day. You know, I texted the majority leader a few times. I talked to him multiple times throughout the day. It seemed like his opposition was softening throughout the day. I'm still against it, but I'm not going to stop others from voting, you know, for it, that kind of thing. And that is the type of day, you know, when we talk about what happened, what didn't happen. We were waiting to the very final minute of the Senate, and it could have come up at any moment and didn't.
And it never did. All right, that's a good time to bring you in, Andrew. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Why did you decide that you wanted to really take this up as a major editorial concern of the AJC?
Well, good morning to you all, and thanks for having me. It's great to be here. It's simple. It's because it was the right thing to do. I think there are certain issues, and we lose track of this sometimes in all of the sausage making and the back and forth and the excitement. And, you know, we can all sit and watch the great Schoolhouse Rock video of how a bill becomes a law. You know, there's great insight into all the sausage making, but at the end of the day, we lose track of the fact that, you know, our elected officials are there to serve the people and to serve the state of Georgia, right? And I think this issue is one that is really important. And we ought to be able to say sometimes that while there are lots of different concerns, we should work to address different concerns around issues. But let's keep in mind what's really important. And so we took it up, Bill, because we have this treasured natural resource. We have something in the state of Georgia that can be as special to this country as the Grand Canyon or the Everglades or the Cascades. You know, it is a true natural wonder. And the fact that it is being held hostage to some private interests and frankly to the business interests of an Alabama mining company struck me as wrong. So I'm proud of the reporting Greg has done on the political front, the reporting Drew Kahn has done, our environmental reporter, on the facts of the case. They've given our audiences the facts. And when you look at the facts of this, you know, to me, this was just an important issue for us to throw our hat in the ring on.
So one of the opponents of the measure that finally came up to be voted on, which would have sort of put a pause, not an end to mining near the swamp, but just a three-year pause. One of the arguments that those opposed it have is, well, Andrew, the Environmental Protection Division, the people who are charged with understanding what's good and bad for the environment, they okayed this measure. Why isn't that good enough, Andrew Morse?
Well, again, when you sit and you think about some of the rationale behind these arguments, I find it interesting. You don't often hear Republican lawmakers make comments, about the need for regulatory intervention. So I was a bit, you know, kind of puzzled by some of the comments around that, right? You don't often hear it. You know, again, it is up to the EPD for certain to issue those permits. But again, there are certain interests that, frankly, can trump the business interests of an Alabama mining company. The concern now, again, you don't want to dismiss the privacy rights concerns. Those are important. But, the measure, there's work that can be done to address all of that. The idea that the buck should be passed and just put it in the hands of the EPD, which, by the way, serves at the pleasure of the governor, I think is a little bit disingenuous.
Were you disappointed that you didn't get Governor Kemp to weigh in on this?
Well, I don't think this is over. I don't suspect that we've heard the last of this effort. I think between conservation groups and there's several lawmakers who really invested in others, I don't think it's over. So Governor Kemp still has the opportunity to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Andrew, you've talked a lot about the, Mr. Morse. No, I'm joking. you've talked a lot about the environmental groups that are opposed to what the mining company wants to do. But can you talk about, or Greg or whoever, the influences on the other side? It can't just be one company that's kind of convincing so many lawmakers that it's not right. Not just the bill that was on the table this year, but there have been bills that would have gone even further to prohibit mining, period, near the Okefenokee Swamp that haven't gotten any traction, as far as I can tell from Greg and Drew's reporting. So what are those influences on the other side?
Yeah, well, there was the Okefenokee Protection Act, which went nowhere, as you mentioned, Tia. And it was very disconcerting to House lawmakers who had more than 90 signatures on that measure that it didn't even get a hearing this year. It got a hearing last year, but didn't even get a hearing this year with such broad support, let alone get a vote. Look, this is one of those issues where there's a lot of lobbyists involved, but very few people were speaking publicly until this past week, which was insane. Which was, you know, it's one of those issues where you had so many people opposing it, you had very few out front opposing this project, very few out in front supporting it. This is also, Bill, a time where you have policy and also personalities. There's the policy we talked about with Steve Gooch saying, hey, a lot of Republicans are uncomfortable with the legislature getting involved. You also had personalities involved. One of those personalities is a state senator named Brandon Beach, who is a very conservative Alpharetta Republican who had very little influence a couple years ago. Then one of his best friends, his most loyal allies, Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, gets elected. He's now in a position of power, more power certainly than he was a few years ago. And he's upset, not necessarily about the language in the bill, but that his own measure that would prevent Chinese nationals from buying up agricultural land near U.S. military bases was turned into this Okefenokee measure. And he told me he's personally mad about that, and he was urging Burt Jones to back off this bill for that reason.
Well, I think... go ahead, Andrew.
Well, look, Bill, I would just piggyback on that, because I think when you untangle this all, it's really a tangled web. So as Greg said, there are always special interests. But here's what's really interesting. The Okefenokee Protection Act, House Bill 71, right, which stalled three different sessions. I think the deeper I got into this, there were, despite the fact that there were about 90 lawmakers that sort of pledged support and had bipartisan support, the reality is none of them were standing up on the courthouse steps clamoring on the Capitol steps clamoring for it to be brought. So I think that bill was fraught a little bit, and there was thinking that it went too far. And so between conservationists and certain lawmakers, the moratorium was really a compromise. And that's why the failure to bring the moratorium to vote is so frustrating, because that emerged from it. There was a real effort to bring the conservationists along. The conservationists didn't like the original moratorium bill, and they had concerns. They came along. Speaker Burns was concerned about property rights, to Tia's initial question. So mm-hmm. to Greg's point, they're private interests. In addition to the environmental concerns, property rights. Speaker Burns in particular, you know, in the timber industry and there are others, in the area near the Okefenokee who are interested in the timber industry. And so I think rightfully, there are many who are concerned about individual property rights and the precedent that it would set if somehow the property rights of Twin Pines were impinged upon. But again, there are other solutions to that. You can create a conservation easement. You can note the property rights of the mining company and others there. But the compromise bill, to Tia's question in terms of why this failed, why it fell apart, the compromise bill was so amenable to the fact that Speaker Burns brought it to a vote. And he said, well, you know what? I feel that this is a good step forward. I'm going to bring it to a vote. And the fact that the Senate didn't bring it to a vote, my sense is, as Greg said, that's when you get into a lot of special interests. And I think that's really what such a shame.
Andrew, I think it's really worthwhile talking a bit about the swamp itself and why it is such an important resource. You have written in your editorials that, in fact, there are people seeking status as a World Heritage Site for the swamp through UNESCO, which would, as you point out, put it in the company of the Great Barrier Reef, Machu Picchu, the Grand Canyon, and others. I remember when I first moved to Georgia, fairly soon after I got here, I decided to drive down to go to the swamp, and I was overwhelmed. It is an extraordinary place. It feels like no other place on Earth in many ways. The canals with alligators roaming around, gorgeous birds, the open Sea Prairies. Andrew, it is just, it's a marvel. And if there are people who are listening to us who have never made that trip, I can't urge them enough to find some time to do that.
Yeah, it is, again, I think we've seen this movie before. In the 1990s, DuPont, the DuPont Chemical Company, was trying to do something similar to what Twin Pines was doing. And ultimately, that effort was stymied because Newt Gingrich, the Republican Speaker of the House, partnered with the Clinton administration, as odd as that sounds, and a lot of others, to come up with a solution to do the right thing. And at the time, Bruce Babbitt, President Clinton's Interior Secretary, said, I'll paraphrase, what a shame it is that we would sacrifice an uncommon resource for the mining of a common mineral. And we got to remember, the titanium dioxide that they're looking to extract, this is not some precious material that is in scant supply. This is a material that's most commonly used in toothpaste whitener and powdered donuts, and you know the little white lettering on M&Ms? That's what this is. But what a shame, Bill, as you said, to sacrifice this uncommon natural resource. They could be a UNESCO World Heritage Site for a common mineral.
Not you require me to choose between powdered donuts and the Okie Finokie. That's a hard choice. No, I'm joking. So, Andrew,
totally
I want to...
Tough call, too.
You know, but it's interesting because you don't think about where that stuff comes from, and the same thing you see on powdered donuts is the same thing that's in whitening toothpaste. So that's just an interesting fact to kind of process in your brain. I wanted to ask more broadly, from time to time since you've become president and publisher, the AJC has kind of done these, and it happened occasionally before as well, but we occasionally, the editorial side, the business side, if you will, does take a stand and maybe do a front page editorial or really get involved. But I feel like you've stepped that up as to where you kind of the greater Georgia and where you embrace that, not just again on our reporting side, but on the opinion side. Can you tell me about that? Just kind of your vision for what the AJC should be, not just on topics like the Okie Finokie, but other issues where you've weighed in a more hands-on side of it.
Well, it's a good question, Tia, because it's unusual. It's different. We're doing something different, or at least different that hasn't been done in recent years. The AJC has a really proud tradition of standing up for what's right in the community. There was an editor and publisher named Ralph McGill, of course, and you know, I don't by any means, my name shouldn't be used in the same sentence as Ralph McGill. I referenced that to note that there was a time when the AJC, through Ralph McGill, was out there, was taking a stand on the issues that mattered. And as a result, people could depend on the AJC to weigh in when it mattered most. And the areas where I've decided to weigh in with my voice or issues, they're not partisan. You will not see me weighing in on an issue supporting a Democratic cause or a Republican cause. They're not partisan. They're common sense solutions. And so I'll common sense solutions in the interest of the people of Atlanta and Georgia and the South. The first one that I wrote was last summer when I thought Atlanta deserved a shot to be host to the DNC. And I would have written the same piece about the RNC. That was just important for our city. The next one that I wrote was after that horrific shooting in Midtown. And it was a piece, it wasn't calling to take people's guns away. It wasn't calling to arm everybody. It was calling for common sense solutions and for Governor Kemp, who has the ability to really transcend as a leader, to do something to drive change. We wrote one about the police training center, a hotly contested idea, a hotly contested and debated topic, but that tried to put forward common sense solutions. And the Okie Finokie, same thing. Not political, common sense.
Greg Bluestein, we got time for one more question.
Well, let's talk about where we're
or
going.
Or comment.
Yeah, let's talk about where we're going next.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You wrote in one of your pieces, the governor has the opportunity in his second term to cement his legacy as an environmental champion, leapfrog his political rivals by urging action. You say Senate action, that's too late. But now what? How does he have a chance to make all this happen, Andrew?
Well, look, I mean, you know, the reality is, the question is, you know, I don't think anybody's giving up. I don't think anybody's folding their tents and saying this issue is done and dusted. And I think, you know, I suspect the perspective from the governor's office will be it is not our place to direct the EPD what to do. I think the reality is if Governor Kemp were to stand up and cement his legacy for the next generation and say, this is important to the people of Georgia, I want to be remembered as the governor who stood up and protected the swamp, that he might be able to exert some influence that would work in the favor of protecting the swamp.
All right. Well, it's interesting to hear you say that this cause is not over with. You're not giving up on this. Andrew, you're going to stay with us for a few minutes while we take questions from our listener mailbag? I love that. Let's take a break then. This is Politically Georgia from the AJC.
Our journalists at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution are working around the clock to keep you updated on all the developments surrounding the Trump indictment. Now the AJC is putting all of our coverage in one place with our new Trump 19 newsletter. Every Wednesday, you'll have our latest coverage and analysis on this historic case in your inbox. So sign up for free today at ajc.com/indictment newsletter. That's all one word. ajc.com/indictment newsletter.
Welcome back to Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We've got a great offer for Politically Georgia listeners. For a limited time, you can subscribe and get digital access to the AJC for $1.99 per week for life. That's right, $1.99 a week for life. You can subscribe by going to ajc.com/start. That's ajc.com/start. It's a great deal for a greater Atlanta. And by the way, this is for new subscribers only. All right, let's get right to it. Shani B., listener mailbag, what do you got for us?
You know what? We are so grateful to our boss, Andrew Morse, that I think we should have a statue of him at the Georgia Capitol.
Is this a segue?
It is a segue. It's a poor segue, but it is a segue. To our first question, this is Chris from Statesboro.
The push to erect a statue of Clarence Thomas at the Georgia Capitol has me wondering about the Georgia statues at the U.S. Capitol. In 2021, there was a push to replace the statue of Alexander Stephens, Georgia governor and vice president of the Confederacy, with one of John Lewis. I believe Governor Kemp supported this too. But the U.S. Capitol website still lists the Stephens statue in Statuary Hall. Can you provide an update?
So, Tia, I believe I'm correct that the House voted to remove a number of the Confederate statues in Statuary Hall, but that's never happened because the Senate didn't take it. So Alexander Stephens still stands there, right?
So I think Alexander Stephens must be a hard to move statue because it doesn't have to be in Statuary Hall. That's the architects of the Capitol get to, because Statuary Hall can't fit all of the state statues. So they could have moved it. They can't send it back. Georgia has to decide which two statues it sends.
Right.
And Georgia as a state would have to decide it wants to swap out the Alexander Hamilton Stephens statue with the statue of John Lewis or anyone else. But it doesn't have to be in Statuary Hall. It is. It is on display right now as we speak in a very prominent position. But yes, the House wanted to remove all of the statues featuring Confederates, send them back to the states, but that bill did not pass the Senate. That was a few years ago.
Yeah, and this is such an interesting situation because there is this bipartisan coalition in Georgia. Governor Brian Kemp, the late Speaker David Ralston, the former Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, all backed this years ago. You know, and in more recent years, guys, John Lewis's name has been replaced in some conversations with Hank Aaron.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Andrew, like me, you're a transplant from up north. You come down here and all of a sudden you're surrounded by a lot of Confederate imagery that we're not quite sure what to make of.
Yeah, no, it's different. You know, I remember the first time, you know, frankly, the first time driving around and I've been back and forth to Atlanta for years.
Sure.
It's not like I'm a stranger to the South, but the first time you really drive around, you see a Confederate flag waving, it really gives you pause. And it's not something you see walking around the streets of New York City.
or even all the historical markers. That, I think, is what struck me when I moved to Atlanta, is just all these literal signs reminding you that this was kind of a big battleground for the Confederacy.
All right, we got time for one more question, Shaney B.
We sure do. Nancy from Dunwoody wants to follow up on a bill that passed the legislature just a month or so ago.
My question is, what's going on with this America First license plate that I don't like having to drive around with? Can you guys update what's going on with the America First license plate thing? Thanks.
Well, it didn't actually pass, did it, Greg?
Oh,
it passed one body.
Passed the Senate?
Yeah.
It was one of those culture war legislative pieces that did not pass the House. It died last night or early this morning, but it's exactly right. It would have been an America First license plate. So a lot of Republicans and Democrats saw it as a pro-Trump license plate. And Bill, interestingly enough, even a Democratic lawmaker, Josh McLaurin over in the Senate, said, you know what, we might as well go all in. You might as well call it the Donald Trump license plate, and it actually sponsored a resolution to make it such.
Andrew, I thought about the fact when this first came up that license plates can cause controversy. For a long time, when I used to cover New Hampshire primaries, I'd see that live free or die on the New Hampshire plate. And that was controversial for a very long time, too.
Well, I grew up in Maryland. And so you drive around and the license plate slogan in Maryland used to be Maryland is for crabs. So, so go figure. Maryland is for crabs. But also it's worth noting, by the way, there was a measure to introduce an Okie Finokie license plate and that failed too. So couldn't even get Save the Okie Finokie on a license plate.
Well, all right. That we really appreciate the calls we've gotten from our listeners. And by the way, if you have a question for us, you can call us at 770-810-5297, 770-810-5297. Andrew, I know that you have a schedule that you've got to keep. So we're going to let you go and move on with our final segment today. We're going to talk about who is up and who is down. And those of you out there who can't see us on Zoom would see Tia's head bobbing to the music.
Yeah.
So Tia, who's down?
So this one's going to be, they're up but also down. All those reporters who were there burning the midnight oil, they're down a little bit this morning. People like Sam and Greg who got right back up and went right back to work today. So I'm claiming you guys as my who's down only because I know you guys are exhausted. But you being down today has lifted all of us up because we appreciate your coverage of the legislative session.
Oh, we took a picture with all of us around,
yeah, it was a great picture.
Around noon, and then we took a much smaller picture with all of us around 11. There was 11 p.m.
Who's your down, Greg?
Mine are sports gambling advocates. We didn't really talk about this in today's show, but they face tough odds and a ton of bad cliches, but couldn't get enough lawmakers to buy in. That's despite bipartisan support and backing from business boosters and sports teams. So I think we're going to be right back here next year, Bill, talking about the same issue.
All right. So let's pause for just a second and talk for a moment about that, because you're right. We didn't get to it earlier. What's going on here? I mean, this bill has failed time and time again, despite, as you say, bipartisan support. Who's holding this up?
Yeah, part of the reason there's an issue over how it's going to be crafted, is it going to be a constitutional amendment, which would require a much higher threshold than a referendum for voters, or just a simple legislative change? Part of the reason is deeper, though. The casino advocates are really worried that if sports betting passes without legalizing overall gambling, that they'll lose a shot. They want it to be an overall package rather than a piecemeal thing. And so behind the scenes, a lot of casino advocates are pushing against legalizing sports betting.
So are the casino lobbyists still down there in the kind of full force they were a number of years ago when that was really a big push?
Not in the same full force where they were out there in front present saying this is going to pass this year. But at the same time, horse racing, casino, gambling advocates, they want all of gambling legalized in one fell swoop because they worry that if it's sports betting first, that they'll lose some of their impact.
All right, thank you.
And I just want to note, 38 states and D.C. have legalized sports betting now.
Thank you for that. My down is the state Senate. They showed themselves to be cultural warriors who wanted to play pretty much specifically to their base. They got a big brush back from the House. Most of those measures that they wanted to pass failed. And I think in the long run, you know, Mary Margaret Oliver said on the show the other day, one of the issues in the Senate is that a third of them all want to run for higher office. Now, I don't know if it's quite that, but they did seem to be terribly interested in having issues to run on. So they're my down for the week. Greg, who's your up?
Well, I'll piggyback on that. My up is gay rights advocates. They went into the final day of the legislative session on the defensive. I can't overstate that enough. They had so much pressure against them, and they ended the day or the early morning this morning overjoyed. Every single measure targeting the LGBT community failed in the final day. Even a provision to block transgender girls from competing in high school sports that I thought would actually pass.
Go. Yeah. Tia, you're down. I mean, you're up.
Up. I want to go up because my up is me and Greg and Patricia and all the listeners, because we got Bill Nigut with us, and I wasn't on the show yesterday, which was his actual birthday.
I
want to wish you a happy birthday, Bill, and we appreciate you being with us, teaching us. You're the legend, and we are just happy to be in your presence. So happy birthday.
Well,
happy
thank you. I would have never thought a year ago that a year later, when I celebrated my birthday again, I would be a member of the staff of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and it is one of the proudest aspects of my career to work with all of you. All right, my up is Beyonce. I'm a great lover of country music. I always have been. And I like the old time country music more than the newer stuff. But I also used to worry because I know that country traditionally has had a shadow of racism hanging over it. So when Beyonce comes out with her first real true country album, it's got other stuff on it as well, but it's called Cowboy Carter. It dropped at midnight last night. And I think it's wonderful if the country music community takes the advantage of this to start welcoming in mixed voices, which they are doing to some extent. And my dream is to be able to see Beyonce perform on the stage of the Ryman Auditorium, the mother church of country music. That will really be a breakthrough for minorities in country. So congratulations, Beyonce. We're out of time. That's it for us for this week. T and Greg, it's been a long week. Greg, especially for you, lots of news in the legislature. I hope you get some rest this weekend before you start right back up on Monday.
Oh, don't worry about that. We'll get plenty of downtime.
And Tia, we look forward to seeing you again when you're back with us on Politically Georgia. That's it. You can now hear Politically Georgia live weekday mornings at 10 on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta, or you can continue doing what you're doing right now. Follow Politically Georgia on your favorite podcast app and hear new episodes every afternoon. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review and share Politically Georgia with a friend. Join us again on Monday for Politically Georgia from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I'm Ernie Suggs, race and culture reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
And I'm Ned Ravone, lifestyle columnist. Atlanta has been known as the Black Mecca for so many years, but that means something different to everybody.
It means everything to me. I've been living here for 24 years, and I am still amazed at how rich the city's Black culture continues to grow. Every day I wake up, I learn something new.
Well, you all can learn something new by subscribing to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's new newsletter called Unapologetically ATL. It's all about the people, the events, and the entertainment happening in Metro Atlanta that Black people might want to know about.
Like historically Black colleges and universities.
Atlanta's thriving arts scene.
And the city's growing neighborhoods.
Wherever you live, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what issues are important to you.
So subscribe today at www.ajc.com/unapologeticallyATL.
Only from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.